Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Federal Communications Commission in December voted to abolish net neutrality regulations put in place under the Obama administration. Some states have protested by taking regulation into their own hands. California, New York, Washington, and most recently Nebraska have introduced bills to regulate internet service providers. Tech writer Sean Kapton has been covering this for Fast Company. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good morning.
So the battle over net neutrality, it's far from over. What are we, you know, what are they doing at the state level specifically?
They're kind of trying a multifaceted approach. You know, there's a question about whether states can regulate ISPs and their service providers directly, because that's kind of the province of the Federal Communications Commission, and there's going to be a fight over that. So they're also looking at kind of indirect ways, essentially, for example, withholding state contracts from companies that don't meet net neutrality requirements as defined by the state, restricting access to like right away, for example, for laying fiber optic cables or installing cell phone transmitters. So some kind of ways of making life difficult for companies that don't adhere to the policies that states would like to see implemented.
What's a common denominator between California, New York, Washington, and Nebraska in introducing bills to regulate internet service providers? Why those states in particular?
That's a good question. The common denominator, one of them between California and New York, actually, is a personal relationship between two senators, Scott Wiener in California and Brad Hoyleman in New York. They're actually long-term friends, and they often collaborate on legislation.
Uh-huh.
But something, I guess, in terms of policy-wise, I mean, they're, you know, mostly, except Nebraska, you know, overwhelmingly blue states. And there's definitely a political angle to it as well. I mean, a lot of what I'm seeing, there's a lot of sort of anti-Trump language mixed in with the language around net neutrality. I mean, it has a partisan aspect to it.
Okay.
So that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. And in Nebraska, what are they worried about?
You know, I think the same concerns. You know, a lot of surveys have shown that both Democrats and Republicans favor net neutrality, the concept of it, and generally regulations on it as well. So I think that the same kind of concern that everyone has, it is, I think, among citizens, a bipartisan issue.
Mm-hmm.
And at least in some legislators, we're seeing you know, people on the Republican side as well supporting it.
Right. A University of Maryland poll found that 75% of Republicans support net neutrality. Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine's office has said that they have no plans to join litigation. DeWine is a Republican running for governor. What are the political metrics of this then for someone like a Mike DeWine?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. I mean, advocates of net neutrality are saying this is going to become a campaign issue in 2018.
Right.
I think that's very possible. I mean, the thing is, there are so many campaign issues, and they're probably ones that are better understood by the majority of people or that are more top of mind. So I think it remains to be seen whether or not it will be. But, you know, that survey and many others, you know, pretty much make it clear that there's sympathy on the Republican side as well for regulation.
According to the FCC, states cannot enact legislation that would preempt its policy. Has that been tested?
Well, it has in the past. And there, you know, one example was in, I believe it was in 2016, a court decision came down. The FCC had been trying to prevent, this gets a little complicated, but prevent state laws that would restrict communities from expanding their broadband network, so community-owned broadband. So this was under the Democrat-controlled FCC. And it turned out that they were not, ultimately, a court ruled that the FCC was not able to sort of meddle in state policy. So there's that, and there's some other cases where the FCC has, in the court's opinion, overstretched its influence on state policy. But I'm not sure that those are going to necessarily apply in this case, because generally under the Constitution, interstate commerce is something that's regulated by the federal government, and that's a very well established, and it's kind of the establishment of almost all federal regulation. So I'm not sure that these other cases that are kind of very specific to don't meddle in states' internal affairs are going to carry over in this kind of situation.
Besides enacting laws, besides litigation, what are some strategies that are being used to get around any restriction from the FCC?
I mean, one thing is that it's up to every single ISP now how they're going to, what their policies are going to be. And, I mean, all of them have said they support net neutrality, but there are certainly cases of some smaller ISPs. In San Francisco, for example, which is where I'm calling from, the most vocal one is one called Sonic, where they've been very vocal about saying they're going to adhere to net neutrality policies. So it definitely can be up to every individual ISP what they're going to do or not. And it's not clear, of course, there's rhetoric and then there's practice, and it remains to be seen what they're actually going to do.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the fallout from the vote by the Federal Communications Commission to put the kibosh on net neutrality policies established during the Obama administration. My guest right now is Sean Kapten. He's a tech writer for Fast Company. He has written about this. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can check out our Facebook page as well. The creation of fast lanes on the internet is a big worry for net neutrality advocates. Can you talk about that concern and tell us what states are doing to address that issue?
Yeah, that's the real fight. At least philosophically, all sides say that there's basically three aspects of net neutrality. There's no blocking, it's basically just saying you can't go to a site. No throttling, saying you don't get enough bandwidth to go to certain sites. And then there's fast lanes, which is essentially saying that either because an ISP is paid an additional fee from a content provider, or because they want to make it easier for people to get to a certain site, they're going to provide better bandwidth, a wider lane. This is a big concern with things like, you know, Verizon right now, or maybe Comcast, a better example, is also a huge owner of content sources. I mean, they own NBC Universal. So will they provide a fast lane, say, for NBC video, easier way, make it easier to get that, get better quality, you know, than they would for competitors? That's a big fear. And that's really where I think state legislation is going to be the most impactful, or is trying to be the most impactful, because, like I say, there's at least philosophical agreement about not allowing blocking or throttling. But there is a belief that fast lanes is okay. Federal legislation, for example, that Marsha Blackburn, Congresswoman, has introduced would not allow blocking or throttling, but it basically says fast lanes are okay. So that's really, I think, the big contention issue among legislators right now. And that's something that state laws are all addressing, because they see that that's someplace where they're not getting federal support in Congress.
Matt in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I don't really know too much about municipally owned internet services, but I think there's been a couple around the country that have then faced kind of a legal backlash from the corporate ISPs. So could municipally owned internet be a mechanism to preserve net neutrality?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we're seeing a lot of talk about that lately. Some municipalities are actually talking about building broadband networks. Probably they were thinking about it anyway, but this is helping them to make the case for it, because they think that was your net neutrality regulations. So nothing can stop them, of course. Every ISP really can do what they want. People see that as one option.
Okay, Matt, thanks a lot for that call. Gabriel in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just read yesterday that the Senate gained at least 30 names to bring up to challenge the FCC's ruling. And what does that look like? Can they pass something with 51 votes to overturn the FCC's ruling?
Yes, that just came through yesterday. They got to the 30 votes, which they need to bring it to the floor. And yeah, they can't pass it by a simple majority. Of course, they have to do that in the House as well. And there is also companion legislation moving through the House I think that's going to be harder, as we see in a lot of cases where the Senate, Democrats have more control in the Senate. I think what it will do at the very least is put every senator on record. And I think that's one thing the Democrats want to see going into the elections.
Sean Captain, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time. Sean Captain? Okay, we have officially lost Sean Captain. He is a tech writer for Fast Company. We will continue our Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, it was revealed that billions of computers, tablets, and phones contain critical security flaws. Unlike many cyber vulnerabilities, these flaws are not in the software, but the hardware, the computer chips. The two security holes have been ominously named Meltdown and Spectre. They are just some of the many cyber threats that consumers and corporations have to guard against in the coming year. Joining us by phone is San Francisco Bureau Chief of MIT Technology Review, Martin Giles. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Tell us a little bit about Meltdown and Spectre. How were they discovered?
So security researchers have been sort of circling around these flaws for a couple of years. They've sort of known that there's something up. They couldn't quite put their fingers on it. But then last summer, three different teams effectively came to the recognition that there was a fundamental problem with the way these chips worked. And so it was really last June they alerted the companies involved, principally Intel, which makes a lot of these chips, and said, look, you know, there's a problem here.
Are they flaws, but unintentional flaws?
They're unintentional flaws. I mean, so there's, as you mentioned, there are two. So there's Meltdown and there's Spectre. Meltdown principally, I mean, based both of them, what they do is they take advantage of something called speculative execution. And what that means is a chip, essentially, rather than waiting for some instructions, it goes and anticipates something. It anticipates what you and I might want the computer to do next. Mm-hmm. And it goes and searches for data that will make that process swifter, faster. And in doing so, what it actually has done is exposed ways in which hackers could come in and mount what's called a side channel attack and effectively get access to data that's stored in the core memory of a computer. So that's things like passwords or cryptographic keys to unlock data that's supposed to be kept secret.
Have those flaws been exploited yet?
Well, we don't have any evidence of that, of any exploitation. But, you know, these flaws have been around for decades in some cases. So the chances are that somebody somewhere has worked out how to use them, or at least one of them. The Meltdown one is relatively easy to exploit. Spectre is much harder for reasons that I won't go into here, but it's just much harder to do.
What's the significance that the security holes are hardware versus software? Well, the hardware problem is with the computer chips.
Right. So let's think about this as an analogy. Most attacks come through software. So there's a bug in code that runs on the hardware. These are flaws in the actual hardware themselves. And I kind of like use an analogy with construction. So imagine you have your house and there are bolts in the foundations that attach it to the underlying ground. And you discover that there's a problem with those bolts. And so it's a fundamental issue with the sort of security and robustness of the house. And that's kind of what we've discovered here, a kind of fundamental issue with the robustness and security of the hardware that's in the computer. With software flaws, you can sort of issue a new sort of piece of code, a patch, that basically fixes the flaw. In this case, it's much harder because you have problems in that underlying foundation. And so I think, you know, the question is, what do you do about that? Mm-hmm. And it's, again, coming back to that sort of foundational sort of analogy. It's like if you have bolts in a house, in a foundation here in San Francisco where I am, you might want to replace them because if there's an earthquake, the whole lot could come down. Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with the geology of Ohio, but I imagine maybe it's sort of safer in Ohio. So you might want to like leave those bolts there rather than go to all the cost of ripping them out mm-hmm. and try and find some other solution that would sort of protect against the house coming down.
Okay, so what's the parallel then between a San Francisco threat and, you know, what would be a place where there'd be a greater threat
sure.
in these terms? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, for example, if I have a computer that's running a particularly sort of important process for a transportation system or for an airport or an airline, you know, I might want to sort of think very hard about whether I actually replace the entire, well, at least the hardware chip or the entire computer in that situation versus something that's just running a kind of program that, keeps your accounting working. Hmm. So it's the sort of gravity of the consequences if a hack occurred that you need to take into account here. Now, you know, a lot of the companies, a lot of the chip companies and other tech companies are rushing out kind of software patches that try to address this underlying issue.
Kind of like and maybe cases, I hope the energy grid people and that kind of a thing.
Yeah, you got it. So I think that's exactly the kind of, it's like trying to work out what could the consequences be. And we're hoping that we can find ways in which software solutions can address this underlying issue. But there's no sort of guarantee, particularly in the case of Spectre, which is pretty hard to deal with.
Well, how have the chip makers responded?
Well, so interestingly, they've known about this since kind of June time, as I mentioned last year. Mm-hmm. And what they've been trying to do is work with the researchers to come up with solutions to the problem so that when it came out that there was this problem, there would already be solutions available. In fact, actually, the news leaked out very early this year. And so they were forced to sort of scramble to try and issue software updates to fix things. And they've said so far, they're like, it's not a hardware issue. We're not going to do a massive replacement of all the chips that are out there. We're going to find other ways to patch this.
What about the chips they're making now?
Well, you have to assume they're going to very quickly change the architectures of those chips such that they don't have these vulnerabilities in them. And it's actually a critically important issue because we are heading into a world where computers are going to be fundamental in all kinds of areas of our lives. There's a lot of talk about artificial intelligence programs, you know, making decisions for us. A lot of talk about the Internet of Things, where we hook up all kinds of physical objects to the internet. Mm-hmm. Each of those objects, each of those AI programs, they run on hardware. And we need to make sure that that underlying hardware is safe and secure.
You recently wrote as well about big cyber threats to watch for in 2018, cyber attacks like the one on the credit reporting agency Equifax are something we might see more of, you said?
Yes, I think so. I mean, we've just been talking about hardware, to crack hardware. That's quite difficult. You know, there are billions of lines of software code out there, and a lot of them have bugs in them. And hackers are excellent at spotting these bugs and then exploiting them to get into computer systems to steal data. As you mentioned, we saw the Equifax hack last year, which exposed, I think about 142 million Americans' data, social security numbers, credit card details, et cetera, to the hackers. That's a concern, but there are a whole bunch of other companies out there that hold large amounts of data about us. And for hackers, that's a dream. They're dream targets. You know, you can sell that information on a black market for significant sums of money.
Then 2017 saw a wave of ransomware attacks. Give us a primer again on what ransomware is and some of the big high-profile cases and why they're so popular.
Why? The answer, because they work. The last bit of that question, which is excellent, is why are they so popular? The answer to that is money. As the name suggests, ransomware is about charging a ransom. So it is software that effectively, you know, targets data in a company's systems and locks it up. It encrypts it. And so you can't get access to that data, and it can stall programs from running. It can cause all kinds of chaos. And the hacker says, hey, look, you know, if you pay me X amount of money, usually in some kind of hard-to-trace cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, then I will give you the key that unlocks that data again. And so we saw a bunch of attacks last year. The National Health Service, the hospital system in the United Kingdom, was targeted. Here in San Francisco, the light rail service was targeted over Thanksgiving weekend. Ransomware actually shut down the ticketing systems. And so we got to ride for free, which I'm sure they were delighted about. But actually, you know, the implications of ransomware being able to take over a transportation system's computers and shut them down is actually pretty terrifying when you think about it.
You mentioned artificial intelligence a little while ago, as far as something like Meltdown and Spectre are concerned, but you wrote that advances in AI will be a boon to hackers in 2018, you know, right away.
So effectively what artificial intelligence is trying to do is to give computers the ability to sort of think and act like us as humans.
Kind of like the speculative execution stuff.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, you know, with speculative execution, I say it's like a waiter coming and bringing your, you know, filling your glass before you even know it needs to be filled. Mm-hmm. You're like, wow, that's great. You anticipate it. So artificial intelligence is getting to the point where it can sort of anticipate what we need. At the same time, a lot of this is about automation and sort of being able to do things at large scale using software. And if you think about it, if I'm a hacker, what I'm doing, I'm running a business, right? I have people who are working for me who are trying to, you know, penetrate different systems, and I need to sort of force multiply their activities. And what artificial intelligence is going to do is let me do that. And I'll give you a specific example. Phishing, which is spelled P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, right. Not the kind where you go with a rod, but what people are phishing for, hackers are phishing for, is people's passwords, people's sort of security codes. And what they try and do is they try and send in fake emails that look real. And we've now got to the stage where artificial intelligence software can actually match the abilities of humans to generate these kinds of emails. And I'm sure you've received, we've all received sort of these funny, strange things that say, please, would you, you know, give us this or send this amount of money here? And so AI could actually industrialize that process, so we could see a huge increase coming in those kinds of attacks.
We've talked a little bit again about the issue of power grids and transportation systems. Why, these are so critical. Why is it so hard to protect them? Why is it because there's just so much at stake, and there are more hackers, there are more actors after them?
Yeah, I mean, I've probably been a bit of a Cassandra on the call so far. You're saying like, oh, well, we should all just shut up shop and sort of stay in our house and lock the door, hope the bolts hold in the foundations.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's not the case. I mean, in general, security has been pretty good. We go out, we take transport, public transport often. It's fine. It works. So in general, security is relatively good, but we are heading into an era where more and more things are being connected to the internet. So everything from sort of trains, transport systems, to energy and power grids. And a lot of these things that are being connected, they're kind of old machines, right? They've been around for maybe, you know, a decade in some cases or more. And they weren't designed, and their software and hardware weren't designed for the internet era. And so unless we are very careful, we could be hooking up systems to the web, which allows hackers to then come in and try and attack them through the web, that don't actually have robust protections. So it's really critical that we think very carefully, A, about what we're hooking up, and B, about the kinds of protections that are there to prevent attacks against them.
And speaking of Bitcoin in in connection with ransomware, hackers have also set their sights on cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin. What kind of cyber threats are there out there to that?
Wow, that's a great question. So we're in a completely new world here with these cryptocurrencies, as they're called. So basically, it's software. It's not like a hard – I don't have like a dollar in my hand. I have a bit or a byte on my computer that represents this currency. And so what's been happening is in some cases, hackers have been trying to break into wallets, these digital wallets that hold these currencies, and actually steal the currencies. So that's one kind of attack. So if any of you have any sort of Bitcoin or other kinds of currencies out there, be very careful with your digital wallets and how they're protected. But the second thing that's going on, and we're seeing this more and more, is hackers hijacking computers to actually create currencies. So a lot of these digital currencies basically require vast amounts of mathematical processing to actually produce a coin, a Bitcoin, or some other kind of digital currency. And hackers are like, hey, this is great. If we could actually steal processing power, we can actually just legitimately almost like mine coins for ourselves.
So we mean like printing money?
It's like printing money. It's okay. Printing digital money. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is it requires, as I said, a vast amount of computing power to do this. And so what we're starting to see is, you know, large volumes of computers being hijacked to actually work on these mathematical problems instead of doing what they're supposed to be doing. And there was a Russian oil pipeline company towards the end of last year that basically found all of its computers had malware on them. That's a sort of rogue code that was actually mining Bitcoin and using the company's resources and energy to actually do that, as well as doing sort of the day job. There have been reports of Wi-Fi systems in a Starbucks store in Argentina being hijacked by malware, and that then went on to use the computers of the people sitting in the Starbucks to actually mine cryptocurrency. And so the risk is that in taking over a computer, you cause some damage. It's worrying that they're able to do it in the first place. Mm-hmm. The more worrying thing is, what happens if this was a hospital systems? What happens if this was an airport, an air traffic control? So there's all these kinds of concerns out there that are associated with cryptocurrency that you might not ordinarily think of as a straightforward kind of run in, grab the money and get out again.
What kind of penalties can there be for hackers? And maybe to another point, what kind of penalties can there be for companies or entities? Because a lot of things we're talking about are public entities that fail to address these threats effectively.
Yeah. Now we're getting to a really critical issue. It's how do we deal with these threats? And at the end of the day, companies need to take and we as individuals need to take sort of certain basic steps to protect ourselves, protect our system. So if you see a software patch coming through for your phone or your tablet or your any connected device you have, take it upgrade your operating system. That's the best kind of form of defense you have against all of these kinds of attacks that we're discussing, and also make sure you have sort of antivirus software mm-hmm. on your machine. So that's as an individual. As companies, they are the really tempting targets because they hold lots of valuable data, and so here you need to take a whole bunch of different sort of measures, like for example, not running software on your system unless it's been absolutely tested and pre-approved for use, making sure that you apply all the patches that come out regularly, and making sure that your system administrator, the person who sort of oversees your computer networks, doesn't leave their passwords around. So there's sort of basic things. Beyond that, though, we're facing attacks from nation states, from very big organized criminal groups that have deep resources. And at the end of the day, you know, private companies can't fight this. It's like asking a sort of, a commercial shipping line to fight the foreign navy of an adversary power. Mm. We need the government to step up and help here. And it's a big issue. How much resources does the government get to do this? And how much is it actually actively able to help companies fight this fight? And penalties is an important thing in the sense that if, you know, a company doesn't do this job properly, and therefore our data, our valuable information online is exposed, there should be penalties. And right now we're seeing sort of the beginnings of class action lawsuits against some of the chip makers because of the Spectre and Meltdown flaws. Mm-hmm. So there's law. But there's also sort of penalties. So Europe is actually about to introduce in May, it's going to introduce a thing called the General Data Protection Regulations. And these will basically make it, there'll be penalties under these regulations for companies that fail to disclose a breach of data within 72 hours of it happening, if it is very sensitive personal data for customers. And if they don't do that, they can be fined up to 20 million euros or 4% of their turnover. And that's a lot of money for big companies.
It seems like Europe is always more advanced in this realm than the United States.
I think that's right, although there's the sort of moves in Congress to sort of get some kind of federal breach regulation. I think there's something like 35 states currently have regulations that basically require companies also to disclose breaches like this. They have various different kinds of requirements,
right.
So it's a bit of a patchwork quilt, whereas Europe's going to have like one kind of single requirement. And that is a debate. The debate, should America have a single system that every state has to follow from, and it's imposed from federal level, or should this be a state by state issue?
And, you know, it does affect the United States. Uber covered up a big cyber attack last year, and it sparked calls for breach disclosure rules. But you're talking about, again, a patchwork quilt. It's not happening necessarily in Congress.
Right. I mean, there's discussion in Congress about, I think there's even some draft legislation that sort of proposes a kind of federal breach regime, so that there would be law, rules, federal rules that every state would have to apply and that would apply to every company in America. And I think there is a strong case for having, at least a robust discussion about that, because at the end of the day, there need to be consequences that companies will feel if they don't do what they should be doing, the basic steps, as I said, the basic hygiene to protect our data.
Martin Giles, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Martin Giles is a San Francisco bureau chief for the MIT Technology Review. More coming up on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. There has been an increasing awareness of the fact that the devices we love to use and talk about have a dark side. Tech companies have become expert at creating smartphones and apps that draw our attention in a way that can feel addictive, and that may be affecting our lives and relationships in unintended ways. Two large Apple investors have asked that company to help parents protect their kids from the risks of digital addiction in an open letter. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
One of your colleagues at Android Central recently wrote an article about his own struggle with smartphone addiction. For you, this is an occupational hazard, I would imagine. But I heard a doctor talk about it today on NPR and said that you can't really use the word addiction. It's more a cultural thing and a personal thing, but not a physiological thing.
Well, I think that you run into the same kind of splitting of hairs there that you do with whether or not gaming addiction is a real thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you talk about the consequences, you know, I feel like they're a lot closer related in some extreme cases than we may be willing to admit culturally.
How so?
Well, with you see, with gaming addiction, we've had horror stories of you know, parents who have been playing you know, games to the detriment of their children. In some extreme cases, even you know, children dying due to malnutrition. And smartphone addiction is certainly there have not been as extreme a number of cases that have, you know, pointed directly to someone who couldn't put their cell phone down. But you look at adults who blow away, you know, entire savings accounts on games that are, you know, full of microtransactions that are very gambling focused.
Mm-hmm.
You take a look at you know, any number of what we see is kind of hilarious outtake videos where people walk into traffic or you know, trip into a fountain or something like that because they seem just completely unable to put their phone down. That there is some underlying. You know, it may be social, but it's definitely an underlying urge to constantly have that phone in your hand, to be connected, to remain informed, or, you know, on the other side, to remain connected and to continue, you know, communicating with you know, friends, be they real or you know, this perceived internet audience. You know, I feel like there are a lot of layers to it.
Yeah, and because it's not technically a drug, you know, it's not like alcohol, it's not like heroin, it's just a tool, right? It doesn't get the same kind of scrutiny?
But, you know, I think it's also, this was also something really interesting that that Daniel wrote in his article addressing this addiction, is that, you know, there may not be a, you know, a particular chemical that you are ingesting, but your body still releases dopamine, you know, at the result of something pleasant happening on your phone, you know, mm-hmm. reaching down to grab your phone and doing, your body still releases those chemicals that make you feel better about the thing that's happening. So there's still, you know, some control, you know, issue there. And a lot of it is, you know, we talked about this a lot throughout the year, really. You know, it ends up being, you know, very much a, you know, a personal responsibility thing when it comes to adults. But the focus of the letter that that Apple's investors wrote was it children, you know, personal responsibility. If the personal responsibility is not being taught to the children because the adults themselves are also hooked onto these phones, then, you know, the next step is really just a continuation down that spiral.
Well, you're a father of three, right?
I am.
And we've talked about it before, but it's probably worth revisiting. What sort of rules have you set up? Because you are like the gadget king of the century in my world. And, you're, I mean, everyone must think, wow, let's go over to the, you know, the Holly's house and game it up. But you have restrictions, right?
Yeah, I have very firm limitations on the amount of time that my kids are allowed to spend, you know, on technology, particularly during school nights. I'm a little more relaxed on the weekends, but if there's a school night, you're in front of a gadget for something particular. You're working on homework or something like that. You know, there are rare exceptions where as a family, if the weather is really nice out and we've all done everything that we're supposed to, we'll all go out together and play Pokemon Go or do something like that. But there is. You know, definitely hard rules against coming home and immediately connecting to the internet and communicating with friends or in my house anyway.
And where are you seeing the pushback with your kids? I mean, what do you see them more hung up on you know, eager to hang with?
Well, the two biggest things there are communicating with friends and playing games. You know, they all have, you know, games that they enjoy playing. And you know, the format for those games on your phone is that kind of constant cycle where the idea is that you can put the phone down at a moment's notice to do something else. But the miniaturized version of the game makes it so that you don't really have to if you're not doing something else. And, you know, communication happens, you know, across games and apps and email you know, social networks and things like that.
In other news, another tech company is dealing with problems of overheating batteries. What is happening with HP? There's a recall, right?
There's a recall for 50,000 batteries across several different laptop models that HP has released, where they noticed a design flaw. It's not across, you know, entire spectrums of HP's laptops, but it is affecting enough of a number that if you own a modern HP laptop, if you bought an HP laptop within the last, say, year, then you should head to their support website and make sure that your model is not one of the ones that are affected.
How does a battery overheat? Why is this continuing to be a problem? We just want better and better batteries and they just can't take it, or what?
Well, sure. I mean, it's a combination of things. The first is, you know, we're from a tech perspective, you know, everyone wants everything to be smaller and thinner and lighter. But at the same time, the batteries have to have more capacity. They have to have a greater capacity. So the science around that causes some natural problems. If you know, batteries don't meet a certain set of tests and do things like expand over time, or if the materials surrounding the battery don't do a good enough job radiating the heat away from the rest of the computer, then a lot of these kinds of problems can come up. And really, for as long as I can remember, you know, laptops in particular, keeping them from getting warm has always been, you know, one of those kind of warning things that you tell someone who's new to a laptop. Like, don't set your laptop on top of a blanket, use it for, you know, set periods of time and things like that. Because, you know, these things are very small, and heat is just one of the most dangerous things to it because of the damage it can do to the battery.
How many laptops have been affected by this HP issue? Any particular models, or just anything in the last year?
No, so it's really been, you know, it goes back as far as December 2015, I think, as far as the models are labeled. Mm-hmm. And it's HP's ProBook line, the Envy M6 line, the Pavilion X360, and the, I think it's the HP 11 and the HP ZBook. With kind of different models within them. So it, like, if you bought the ZBook from Walmart, then it'll have you know, a certain you know, character after it, like 17 or 17G3, and so that you know, particular model is one of the ones that was affected.
Are we going to start to see signs popping up in airports?
No, this is, you know, so this is a total of, you know, 50,000 units, according to HP, which is not usually small enough to cause this kind of problem. What we saw with Samsung, there were just so many of that phone already out in the wild that it was, you know, it was statistically likely that most flights were going to have somebody on them with that phone.
Okay. The big consumer electronics show called CES is underway in Las Vegas. We're going to talk about that more next week, but you wanted to talk about a new camera, the camera kit from, is it Kano or Kano?
Yeah, Kano. So I love the Kano team. They have done just an incredible job over the last couple of years designing computers that kids are encouraged to assemble themselves.
And, oh, that's right, yeah.
They come with an operating system that just makes teaching the fundamentals of computer technology very, very easy and fun. And they're kind of branching a little bit beyond the, you know, the traditional idea of a computer. And this new kit allows them to build their own digital camera.
Is it the same sort of thing as was it a computer before?
Right. Yeah. So this is the same basic idea as a computer, where, you know, kind of the individual parts are included in the kit, and the kids can assemble the kit. And there's special software that comes with the computer, that comes with the camera, that allows children to do things like create their own filters and learn about how different, you know, how different lighting can affect pictures that you're taking. And so they actually have settings that the children can create themselves for the camera. That will allow for different lighting presets and different color filters, and really learn a lot about how to take a picture.
Yeah,
which was just an incredible thing, the way that it's all set up.
What price education in this case?
They haven't been given a price for this yet, and it's something that we'll probably hear about within the next month or two, because right now it's still an early version of the kit that they're showing everyone right now. But it's really just a fantastic idea, you know, continuing the education of how the technology works instead of just, you know, selling a version of the technology that already comes pre-assembled.
How do the cameras work?
In this case, you know, digital cameras, that, you know, it's all a single lens that doesn't have a lot of, you know, individual articulation or anything like that. You're not going to be learning a whole lot about the way that a camera zooms or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, kind of this contained computer that takes a picture and stores it. and then, teaches you how to, manipulate that photo after you've taken it to, kind of get the effects that you want.
And what age group are we looking at here? What do you think?
I think that this, starts at, probably age 8 or 9 and goes up to 13 or 14.
And release date, did you say that?
This is something that they're going to be shipping within the next 2 months.
Oh, okay. All right. In other CES news, Google made a rare appearance at the show. Rare because the big guys don't really show up. They have their own shows, right?
That's right. And this was an impressive showing with lots and lots and lots of fanfare. They even the words "Hey Google" are kind of plastered all over everything right now. And they built a giant slide going down one of the buildings.
That
you can go and slide down, just kind of because Google has a history of doing very silly things like that.
Well, why are they there?
Well, they have a ton of hardware partners that are all showing off things that have Google Assistant built in, really to compete directly with Amazon's Alexa service.
Okay.
So this is, taking a step beyond the Google Home accessory, and we now see just everything from televisions that have the OK Google service built in to door locks and microwaves and just a ton of things in these new displays that are designed to sit in a kitchen or in a small office or something like that, and offer everything that you would get from a Google Home, but also a display for watching YouTube videos or to cast photos and images to. And have everything just kind of self-contained in that one device that, can either work from your voice or from your phone.
Is Amazon there since Google's there?
Amazon is not there as a company, but they have a lot of different hardware partners that are also showing off accessories that have Alexa built in.
A new kind of competitive era?
This is absolutely, the voice command systems, Google and Alexa are fighting, tooth and nail to get as many people as possible. I think it was recently announced that Google had shipped over 6 million Google Home devices over the Christmas season, due in no small part to the Google Home Mini being, $30.
Yeah.
Which was the same strategy that we saw from Alexa the year before with the Echo Dot. And so, this was, kind of the big first step for Google was getting these smaller units into people's homes. And now there's just this massive ecosystem of things that are going to integrate with it that Google is showing at CES this year.
So what do we know about how people like what Google gave them or sold them, I should say?
The general response has been really positive. Google hasn't released a ton of information about what people are using the Google Home Minis for yet. Mm-hmm. The biggest assumptions is that they get used for things like music streaming or for basic home controls like turning lights on and off or just asking simple questions. But we really don't have like a real detailed example of what Google thinks the average use case is for these right now.
Do you want to preview a little bit about what we might be talking about next week following up on CES? Anything caught your attention?
The biggest thing that caught my attention this week that I wanted to talk about just a little tiny bit was just this massive prevalence of self-driving cars. Not just the individual cars. There are actually services that are driving people around in Vegas right now that don't have anyone in the driver's seat. More than that, just big consumer or big commercial trucks that are going to be doing it as well.
Really, and you can see them, and people are. No one's been hit yet,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, this is a thing. There have been for the last 2 days and then throughout the rest of the week. Lyft is actually partnered with a company that is driving people around in driverless cars for the entire week.
Hmm. It's all happening in Las Vegas. We'll talk about it more next week. But for now, Russell Holly, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time as always.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.